You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Looking for some sparkle under the tree? Kendra Scott has a great selection of gifts for everyone on your list, from a classic pendant necklace to an on-trend statement earring to something customized just for her. Visit KendraScott.com and use promo code KICK or mention this ad in your local Kendra Scott store for 20% off your next purchase. That's KendraScott.com and promo code KICK for 20% off your next purchase. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Whether on the right or left, many Americans have a sense that our democracy is in crisis. And as a people, our fractured partisanship and ignorance on critical issues drive our leaders to stake out even more extreme positions. Now, in a soul-searching and incisive examination of our failing political culture, Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig speaks to every citizen, offering a far-reaching platform for reform that could save our democracy and make it work for all of us. His book is called They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And today, Larry Lessig joins me on the podcast to discuss a fundamental issue that he says underlies many of our current political problems, something he calls unrepresentativeness. He offers some creative prescriptions for how to cure America's unrepresentativeness problem, such as public funding of election campaigns, including campaigns for Congress, a radical restructuring of the U.S. Senate, and some ways that we can reform the Electoral College without having to change the Constitution. He also says we the people are complicit in America's political dysfunction and suggests some ways that Americans can take a more proactive role in government, from civic juries to citizen referenda. Plus, I asked this distinguished legal scholar to weigh in on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Coming up with Lawrence Lessig in just a moment. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, host of the podcast Another Way, and co-founder of Creative Commons. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society. He's also the author of 12 books, including Republic Lost and his latest, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Professor Lessig, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. You've got some great ideas in this book. And before we get to it, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to ask such a distinguished law professor as yourself to weigh in on impeachment. From what you've heard so far of President Trump's efforts to persuade Ukrainian President Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden, do you think that his actions rise to the level of an impeachable offense?
Well, I certainly think that the evidence so far, especially the stuff that President Trump has himself relied upon, demonstrates that there was the kind of exchange that the impeachment clause is explicitly condemning. You know, the impeachment clause doesn't speak just of high crimes and misdemeanors. It speaks of bribery. And bribery is the exchange of something of value to the government, of the government, with something that is benefiting you in a personal way. Mm-hmm. So clearly, when you say, I'm going to release funds or imply you're going to release funds in exchange for information that would be used for the political benefit of the president, that's plainly within the terms of what the impeachment clause would be prescribing. So I think this is really an easy case now, unlike the early questions around the Mueller investigation. This is an easy case now, and the only question is whether the Senate has the will or the conviction to do anything about it.
Okay. But I'm curious, does the impeachment clause provide for the bribery of a U.S. official or the bribery of a foreign official? Is that a little bit of a gray area there?
I think it's the activity of engaging in bribery.
Okay.
and, you know, it doesn't matter who's being bribed by whom. It's just, you know, that is a corrupt act.
Yeah.
It was done for corrupt intent, where corrupt intent means for personal benefit. You know, it's completely okay for the United States president to say to a country, look, we'll give you aid if you agree to help us out in the following treaty, or we'll give you aid if you agree to send troops to help us on the following mission. You know, that kind of exchange, that kind of quid pro quo is totally normal in the context of government. But when you do it to benefit yourself or to benefit your political campaign, then that's what creates a corrupt intent that makes it cross the line from the ordinary workings of government into something policed by bribery.
Well, impeachment has certainly sucked up all the political oxygen over the past month. And as you point out in your book, our attention is drawn to the dumpster fire. As you say, we are wired to be distracted by the dramatic. And you also say that we focus way too much on Donald Trump and his latest offense of the moment, but not enough on the big institutional changes that need to happen in this country. How do we get people to pay more attention to these sweeping long-term problems and less on the more immediate crises?
I'm not sure we can. I mean, I think it's a real tragedy and challenge of this moment. That in some sense, all of us recognize that whatever the problem of the American government, it wasn't caused by Donald Trump. And it won't disappear if Donald Trump is not president. The problems that plague our current government are really systemic, deeply embedded inside of the institution of democracy that we've evolved. And we need to recognize both how those problems will make it impossible for us to address any of the issues that people want to debate about sensibly, whether that's climate change or healthcare or growing an economy or dealing with the debt or, you know, AI or any of the issues people argue about. We cannot deal with any of those issues sensibly so long as we have this deeply broken federal government. And so I think that somehow we have to motivate that attention. But I think we also need to be, recognize that it might be not possible given the nature of the other crises that are before us.
Yeah.
So, I constantly hope that we'd see, for example, Democratic candidates making the issue of corruption more central to their campaign. So far, we haven't seen that at a level that I think translates into political force yet.
Yeah. And in your book, you point to a phenomenon that I see all the time these days. All Americans profess their love for our democracy, but then at the same time, they express a lack of faith in their fellow participants in this democracy, saying that voters are stupid or uninformed or crazy. How does one make sense of America's current love-hate relationship with democracy?
I do think that we've entered this period where, you know, the media renders us kind of ridiculous. You know, we, unlike the era of what we could call broadcast democracy, that's a term that Marcus Pryor, who's a Princeton political scientist, uses to describe the period sort of roughly 1950 to 1985, when, you know, the whole of our culture is focused on a small number of networks who are delivering the news every single day. And, you know, you can't avoid being exposed to that because you want to have your television on, but that's the only thing that's on. So you, you're exposed to this news, this regular news, limited by a very strong journalistic ethic to be down the middle mainstream news. And in that context, when the American people speak through polling, it increasingly seems like sensible talk. I mean, it's just sort of stuff that the progress of the 1960s and 1970s and early 1980s reveals. So, you know, civil rights progress, progress around the war in Vietnam, progress around environmental issues, progress around impeaching Richard Nixon. These are all examples of the public coming to understand something in a sensible way and being reflected in a sensible way through the polling of the time. Mm-hmm. But when you move into the post-broadcast period, beginning in 1985 with cable and then accelerating because of the internet, we begin to be crafted into very separate worlds or realities, as President Obama recently put it, crafted into our partisan tribes. And the business model of both cable news and the internet, or ad-driven internet, is to render us loyal to our tribes and to practice hatred towards the other tribes. And as we live in these tribes and process information within our tribes, in a certain sense, we become more ignorant, not because we know less, but what we know is so deeply affected by our partisan or political views. But then those views get reported in the polls. And so we look at each other and we think, oh, my gosh, how crazy are those people? But they are us just from another perspective. And so we profess this belief in democracy, but are more and more skeptical of we the people inside of this democracy. And I think that is a long-term death of the whole project of democracy.
Yeah. And indeed, you break this book into two parts addressing the us's and them's of this problem. And this is not you otherizing or stoking tribalism. The them to which you refer is the government, and the us's is, well, us, the American people. I found that second part very interesting because I don't hear many people talking about our own responsibility for fixing the system. Do you think citizens are complicit in what you call in this book unrepresentativeness, and why have we largely ignored our own role in this?
I do think we're complicit in the way that I think that we're complicit in the bad practices of eating that mark our society. You know, I mean, and this is an analogy which I take very seriously in the book. So we've got the explosion of processed food in America, which is, of course, at some level irresistible because it's architected. You know, the food science designs it so that the mix of salt, fat, and sugar is irresistible except to those who practice extraordinary self-restraint. So you begin eating the popcorn, or you begin eating the buffalo wings, or you go to Starbucks and you get your double tall caramel soy latte. And the movement that sort of drives people to practices that could be healthier for eating is often called the slow food movement. You know, if you just slow down, you cook your own food, it's not likely. It's almost impossible to eat unhealthily. I try to say there's an analogous slow democracy movement that we need to encourage. There are all these places where we engage with each other on democratic issues that are incredibly unhealthy. Whether it's a Facebook news feed or a Twitter war or watching cable news, Fox News or MSNBC, the partisan or the really polarizing parts of both of those networks. That's unhealthy because what it does is it reinforces this business model of hate, this way of looking at each other in incredibly skeptical and condemning ways, and makes it harder for us to do what we have to do as a nation, which is to come to an understanding or agreement about really important issues that affect all of us.
Yeah.
And to resist that, I think we need to embrace other forms of democratic speech. So I'm a big believer in podcasts. That's why I was happy to be on your podcast. Because the thing about a podcast is it's architected to allow people to get serious and reflective about a topic for long periods of time. I was on the Joe Rogan podcast and, we were talking for 2.5 hours before I realized we had been talking for 2.5 hours. And that's a kind of opportunity and reflection that people can have about political issues that, like healthy food, is healthier for a democracy. Mm-hmm. And while I think there's lots to worry about how to regulate and how to drive people to do the right thing, ultimately, it's each of us who has to make a choice about what kind of member in the democratic society we want to be, whether we want to be somebody who's helping or hurting. And right now, all the pressure is towards being hurtful to the democracy.
Right. And the barriers for entry in podcasting are very low. So there's lots of opportunity for citizen podcasters to rise up and let their voice be heard.
Yeah, heard and rise up and recognize how complicated issues actually are and how it takes time to reflect on them. And you need to reflect in the way that, you know, humans might have a conversation over dinner. It takes time and you have to have other people in the conversation. And that's what democracy has long been about, like learning how to do that. Like, what are the right contexts for citizens to do that?
And, absolutely.
You know, in a certain sense, we've had this radical technical change in a very short period of time that have thrown us into an environment we're completely not used to. And we're reacting the way, you know, it's natural for us to react, especially given the business model of platforms like Facebook to advertise to us. You know, what advertising is not just showing us what they think we might like. Advertising depends on learning as much about us as they possibly can. And they don't learn about us not by just sitting at the side of the road and watching us. They learn about us by tweaking us or poking us or prodding us to say certain things or to do certain things so that as we do those things, they learn more about us. And that whole dynamic is incredibly invasive and also debilitating for the opportunity of us to learn how to engage with each other in a democratically responsible way. So I do think we have a responsibility here, each of us individually, but the solution is not obvious. I mean, as you see at the end of that book, I marched through a bunch of different things we should do, I think we can do. But at the end, I'm not convinced that any of them are going to be enough. I'm not convinced there is a solution to this, given the way technology has taken us over. But I do think we have to fight to try, because if we don't, and just like, you know, monarchy across most of Europe, when people began to think it was ridiculous and support for monarchs disappeared, I think support for democracy is really tenuous the more we see these crazy results that are a product of this unreflective tribalism playing out in democracies and places like Britain and the United States.
And not just here in the U.S., but all over the world, the constant refrain lately is democracy is in retreat. I hear it all the time. Do you believe that democracy is truly in retreat? And if so, why now? Why this moment in history?
I do think it's in retreat. I think it's in retreat because it's producing results that we are deeply skeptical of, both because of them and because of us. I mean, because of them in the sense that, as I describe in the first part of the book, because of the deeply corrupted systems of representative democracy we have allowed to evolve, both here and around the world. But, you know, let's talk about here. You know, we have a system of government that's supposed to be a representative democracy, but there are any number of ways in which it's obviously unrepresentative. So the way we fund campaigns, you know, candidates spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money from a tiny fraction of the 1%.
Right.
Obviously, that produces incentives that are not representative, or gerrymandering, where members in Congress are obsessed with keeping the extremes of their own party happy because they live in safe seats, which means seats that only the party in power could ever win, but they could be challenged in a primary. And of course, the only people you're worried about in a primary are even more extreme versions of yourself. So that creates enormous representational power for the extremes in our political system, and not so much for people who stand in the middle. Or the president gets elected through an electoral college system that only cares about the so-called swing states, the states that could go either way. In 2016, 99% of campaign spending was in 14 states. But those swing states don't represent America. They're older, they're whiter, their industry is not the cutting edge of industry in the world. And so, again, we have a president who cares about not representative America, but this weird swing state America, or, you know, systems for suppressing the vote of the people who don't happen to be in your party that typically express itself in racial terms. So when Texas and Georgia throw people off the ballots, they're throwing people off who are typically people of color. But they also are political. You know, they're typically throwing people off who are Democrats in a Republican state. These are all ways in which we've allowed the representative democracy to become unrepresentative. And so therefore, we are skeptical about what it does because it's not doing what we as the people would want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
But also we're skeptical of each other and our own participation in this democracy because we don't see a lot of good evidence that we can do anything better or that we actually have insight that ought to be guiding this democracy, which is partly why I think we see so many people embracing strongman authoritarian ideas.
Interesting.
Which, you know, it's not the first time this has happened in history. You know, I think about 100 years ago at the decline of democracy leading up to the world wars, you had a similar kind of dynamic. I think that right now it's so much more pervasive and embedded, and the solutions are so much harder to imagine. But that just makes the challenge much more urgent.
Yeah. Well, I want to start by talking about some of the solutions you proposed to the them part of this problem. In terms of government reform, particularly campaign finance reform, you've been a leader on that for a number of years. In your book, you call for public funding of campaigns. Now, we used to have this for presidential campaigns. I think technically we still do, but the candidates themselves turned it down because they could raise more money outside the system. How do you put that genie back in the bottle and convince campaigns to take public financing instead?
Right. So the first thing to recognize is that every one of the solutions is expressing the same fundamental value. Mm-hmm. Let's make the system representative. Mm-hmm. So in the way we fund campaigns right now, tiny fraction of the 1% have enormous power because candidates are obsessed about making them happy so they can get the money from this tiny fraction of the 1%.
Right.
So I think we need a version of public funding that changes that dependency, like changes that corrupt dependency. Mm-hmm. And the version that I support is something like democracy dollars or democracy vouchers, which there are a number of candidates right now who are pushing this idea, including Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang. Kirsten Gillibrand had the most aggressive democracy voucher or dollar program before she dropped out of the race. And what democracy dollars would do is give every voter, you know, think of it as like a coupon, which they then can use to contribute to political campaigns. So candidates would try to recruit people to give them their vouchers or their coupons, and then the candidates could cash them in for money to help them run their campaigns. Well, the dynamic there is if candidates are obsessing about raising lots of small contributions from every single voter who has these coupons, then the candidates are going to be responsive to the people as opposed to responsive to those funders when they're a tiny fraction of the 1%. That's a different system of public funding than the presidential public funding, which basically, you know, they decided how much money each candidate required. And I mean, the candidates required. And once you qualified, they just wrote you a check for that amount.
Right.
That's top-down public funding. I think bottom-up public funding, which is what vouchers are, is a much more democratic and robust way of removing that dependency. And it's one that Congress could do tomorrow without changing the Constitution or raising any difficult constitutional questions.
And you suggest this not just for the presidential election, but also for congressional campaigns as well, right?
Especially Congress. You know, I actually think we could just forget the president. And if we could just fix Congress, we would have an enormously healthier democracy. The weak institution, the broken institution, the failed institution in our constitutional republic is Congress. Hmm. You know, the president is wildly more powerful and energetic and effective than the framers ever imagined he or, I don't know if they imagined a she, but he or she would be. And the Supreme Court or the courts have become incredibly successful in advocating and pressing a conception of the rule of law. Congress is the failed institution in our democracy, and we need to recognize that and think about changes to fix it. And so I get frustrated when I hear these presidential candidates talking about all the ways in which they're going to be holier than thou, not taking money from lobbyists or not taking large contributions or not going to, you know, fundraisers. All of that feels like a gimmick to me, because what they need to be doing is convincing the American public that the real problem to solve is a unrepresentative, wrongly dependent Congress. And we could solve that if we just changed the way they fund their campaigns.
And I want to ask you about perhaps the most audacious proposal in this book. You actually call for a radical reform of the Senate. Explain what you have in mind.
Well, you know, the Senate was a compromise at the founding of the Republic already. Madison was furious at the idea of a Senate that wouldn't be proportional to the population of the states, but instead would be two senators per state. I mean, he eventually sucked it up and accepted the compromise, but he thought it was a mistake to have a republic where you didn't have proportional representation of the representative bodies. And originally, that lack of proportional representation was significant, but it was not as significant as it is today. I think it was something like 14 times difference in population between the largest state, Virginia, and the smallest, Delaware. Today, that number is like 66 times between Wyoming and California. And so what we've seen is a radical increase in the unrepresentativeness of the Senate. And so we got to think about how we can fix it. And the reason it's so difficult is the Constitution expressly entrenches the character of the Senate. It says that you can't amend the clause in the Senate that gives every state two senators, at least as long as they don't consent to something less. And so there's a really difficult constitutional puzzle about whether we could actually even change this or how we could actually change it. But in the book, I describe a bunch of changes that we could make before we actually get to that, changes that try to work against the unrepresentativeness. It's also clear constitutionally that we could do like many nations do, like Germany, and make the upper house, the Senate, much less important in legislation than the lower house. So we could change the powers of the Senate, or we could give the House the ability to override the Senate's veto, you know, which is what the Senate does when the Senate doesn't act on something. So there are lots of changes we could do to try to address this inequality, basically at the core of our republic. And I think we should, even if we don't have the constitutional power to eliminate or to radically change the character of the Senate.
But by making the Senate proportionally representative, aren't you just turning the Senate into a second chamber of the House?
You are, although it's not clear that's a bad thing. You know, most states have exactly that. The state senates have to be proportional, just like the houses.
True.
And you know, it's just a second chance to reflect and to be more deliberative about legislation. I'm not really a strong advocate either for unicameralism or bicameralism. I think Nebraska is a unicameral state that seems to do just fine. So I'm not sure this issue is as important as it was once was to people. But I certainly do think that when we have a system where a tiny fraction of America basically has the power to veto legislative change as well as constitutional change, then there's something wrong with that system. If we can't build a democracy that's responsive to the majority, then we're going to defeat the objective of democracy. And I think that's increasingly what the Senate is producing. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you something I've been toying with myself over the past few months. Do you think America would be better off if we had gone to a parliamentary system? I mean, doesn't it seem like there's some wisdom in a system that requires politicians to build a coalition government and form a true cabinet of rivals that has a diversity of opinions rather than just packing it with presidential cronies?
I do think that there's a good question whether our constitutional system is up to the task of governing in the current age. Although even parliamentary systems like Britain have begun to see the weakness in that design.
Right.
You know, I think, as I argue in this book, actually the Westminster system, which, you know, envisioned just two parties trying to become majority parties, actually produced the most stable and most long-term focused governments that we've had in the context of democracies. And I think that driving us to those types of incentives is a good thing for reform. So, you know, I talk about reform like ranked choice voting, which I think is very important. But one reason it's important is that it both brings outside ideas in, because if you've got a third party candidate or a candidate who's not likely to be the winner, but they have good ideas, then the likely to win candidates are going to take that candidate seriously because they want to get the second votes from supporters of that candidate. So it allows the ideas to be brought in, but it ultimately resolves on a candidate who has majority support within the district. And I think we need more institutions to try to get our leaders to be people who actually represent the majority. I mean, you know, Donald Trump, like Bill Clinton, were presidents who, you know, do not represent the majority. Donald Trump didn't even represent the plurality, unlike Bill Clinton, who at least won the plurality. And this is a weakness in the current system that we've allowed to evolve. And there are lots of things that we could do to eliminate it. So we've been pushing, for example, to have states adopt ranked choice voting in the general election for president. Maine has adopted it, and Georgia, I think, is about to adopt it. And what ranked choice voting would do is basically give your ability to say, okay, think of the 2000 election where 96,000 people voted for Ralph Nader in Florida, and George Bush won Florida by 534 votes. If in 2000 you had said to those Nader voters, look, we'll give you an opportunity to say, who's your first choice? And if that person doesn't win, then we'll count your second choice votes.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 96,000 people who voted for Ralph Nader, I think the vast majority would have made Al Gore their second choice. So that when Ralph Nader was not the winner, then we reallocated his first choice votes to Al Gore. Al Gore clearly would have been the winner carried Florida and therefore would have been the majority elected president in both the Electoral College and in the popular vote. That would get us to presidents who actually could say, I actually won a majority of America's support, as opposed to the system now, which is encouraging more and more presidents who will not win either the majority in the popular vote or even a plurality in the popular vote, which,
right,
of course, is what was true with Donald Trump.
I think there's some wisdom to this because, let's face it, much of the world outside of the U.S. either operates on a ranked choice election or has runoffs.
Yes.
And one thing that's beginning to gain a lot of steam along these lines is the movement to reform or even abolish the Electoral College. It seems to me that it's all the more urgent because, as you pointed out, these inversion elections like what happened in 2000 and 2016 are only going to become more frequent. You acknowledge that a constitutional amendment abolishing the Electoral College is probably a long shot. My question is why? I mean, that seems like the most common sense thing in the world, that every vote ought to get counted.
Well, an amendment to the Constitution requires 3/4 of the states to agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
So 38 states. So are there 13 states who would block an amendment reforming the Electoral College? I think it's clear that there are more than 13 states who would block any amendment to abolish the Electoral College. Even though popular vote for president is popular, actually, since Donald Trump, it's become increasingly unpopular among Republicans. So the reality is we don't, as a nation, have an overwhelming consensus in favor of doing what I think we ought to do, which is just to have a national popular vote for the president.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something less than perfection that I actually think is a possibility, and we're actually working to try to get this amendment teed up. And the idea here is, imagine allocating the Electoral College votes proportionally in each state, according to the proportion the top two candidates get, to the fractional level. So you can imagine a Democrat who won 42% of the vote in Montana getting 1.4 or whatever that would be, electoral votes from Montana. The advantage that that system would have over the current system is that if you're getting proportional votes at the fractional level for every vote you get in the popular vote, candidates would have an incentive to be campaigning in every single state. There would be no swing state bias because if you get a vote in Montana as a Democrat, that's worth as much as a vote in Texas or a vote in California. It's all going to drive to you getting a majority in the Electoral College. So it gets us a more representative president because it's a president who actually can compete and has reason to compete in every single state.
Mm-hmm.
But it still gives the traditionalists or the Republicans or the small people who believe in the Electoral College the way it is the advantage of small states getting two extra votes relative to what their population would say. So Wyoming has a population that is less than the minimal number necessary to get a single representative in Congress. That number is about 700,000. Wyoming has less than 500,000. So Wyoming gets 3 votes in the Electoral College because they get 1 representative and then they get 2 senators. And 3 votes for, less than 500,000 people is an extraordinarily high proportional number of Electoral College votes. But my view is that the consequence of that inequality is relatively small compared to the consequence of running these swing state elections. So I think that this should be a compromise both sides should be open to accepting, that we keep the number of electors as it is right now, but allocate them proportionally at the fractional level. And that would significantly improve the opportunity for a nationally representative president who, if we adopted ranked choice, would not be a minority president, either a plurality president or the inversion president that we've seen twice in the last 20 years.
Well, I want to spend our remaining time talking about the us problems in our democracy, the problems that we, the people, should be acting to address. One of the things that you suggest to encourage more civic engagement is something called civic juries. What would that be, and what kind of matters would a civic jury weigh in on?
Well, one of the conclusions that the skeptical section of the book about the way media has constructed us reaches is that we've got to begin to construct publics that are representative, but informed and reflective, so that their views as expressed are views that we, the people, actually have a reason to respect or actually have a reason to try to promote. And so one part of this intuition is the intuition that all of us, I think, accept about the idea of a jury, right? We delegate to 12 people extraordinary power to decide, you know, whether somebody will be executed or whether, you know, a company like Exxon has to pay $40 billion because of an oil spill. I mean, those are significant decisions, but they get made by this kind of delegated group of us. And that delegation is pretty imperfect. I mean, the 12 people are not representative. They're not large enough to be representative. So it's a pretty imperfect delegation we have for the jury that we could significantly improve upon beyond the context of judicial process. And that's what I think of as a civic jury. So following the work of people like Jim Fishkin, who's developed something called the deliberative poll, this system would say, let's find large number of randomly selected representative people who will be given information on both sides of an issue, given an opportunity to deliberate and talk about the issue, both in small groups and in large groups. And then we take a poll at the beginning of the process and a poll at the end of the process, and we see how they've moved, how have they evolved. And now Fishkin's been doing this for 30 years, and there's been scores of these deliberative polls. And almost universally, you look at the results and you can understand the sensibility or the wisdom inside it. I saw one, really an extraordinary process in Mongolia, where Mongolia has adopted a law that says before they can consider any constitutional amendment, they have to run it through a deliberative poll. So I saw 700 Mongolians randomly selected, representative of Mongolia. Half of them had been on buses for two nights to get to the capital of Ulaanbaatar to participate. And through the course of the weekend, they were deliberating about the constitutional merits of the proposals that they were considering. And at the end, they came up with an incredibly sensible judgment, which then really had an enormous impact on the political discussion that followed. And I, you know, my own view is if it's good enough for Mongolia, it should be good enough for us. Let's find a way to involve us in these processes, not necessarily to make the ultimate decision, but to create a kind of shadow influence where we can say, all right, here's what the crazies in Congress want to do, and here's what the people, given a chance to think and reflect and reason and deliberate, representative, every single section of society, in some sense, standing there. This is what the people properly constituted think. And and that view of what the people properly constituted thinks, I think, would constrain what our politicians do in a way that would be productive and edifying and give them cover to do things that's really hard for them to do. You know, I mean, we constantly reflect on the fact that it's been 20 years since Columbine, but we still have not addressed the problem of gun safety in any significant way. The politicians find it almost impossible, given the influence of money and the NRA and groups like that. But deliberative poll could come up with the right answer and begin to give people almost an excuse to do the right thing. And I think we should experiment with more of this because we need more examples of the people doing something that is something to be celebrated, not something to be scorned at, if we're going to have continued support for the very idea of democracy.
And you highlight several citizen-led referendums that succeeded in places like Michigan, New Jersey, and Maine. Do you think that we could benefit from more referenda and ballot propositions that put questions directly to the voters rather than letting legislators decide? In other words, might the solution to unrepresentativeness be to make this less of a representative democracy and more of a direct democracy?
Yeah, so I'm not for a direct democracy.
Okay.
and the reasons I'm not for it all turn on the problems that I think we see developing with media democracy culture that we now see. Mm-hmm. Like the problem with representative, the direct democracy, is that if you've got people who actually are not informed on the, you know, the issue in a robust or, complete way, you know, if they hear one side of the story from Fox News or one side of the story from MSNBC and they only listen to that one side of the story, then their judgment is not something that people should have a reason to make serious or make part of government. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that I'm against all referenda. I think, in fact, what we've seen, especially in 2018, is that referendum have been very good at rallying people to build movements for reform. We saw more successful referenda in 2018 achieving fundamental reform, from gerrymandering reform to ranked choice voting, and than at any time in American history, even at the progressive era. So I think that they actually can play a role. But having lived in California for 9 years, I can tell you that government by referendum is not sensible government, because yeah. You know, those packets of information are incomprehensible. Look, mm-hmm. I'm a law professor. I should be able to even just read them, and I couldn't read half of them because they were written in a way not to be understood. And so I think the solution is not to turn everything over to the people. The solution is to find a way to have a better representative democracy, which means both improving them by correcting the unrepresentativeness in our system, mm-hmm. and also improving us by giving us ways to participate that, you know, leverage the best of us by having diverse, informed, reflective groups of us participate in a process to at least provide our views.
Mm-hmm. Of course, all of this presupposes a desire on behalf of the public to participate. I don't know if I'm wrong or right here, but I don't see a lot of appetite for that. I mean, it's hard enough getting people to just show up to the polls every 2 years. I might even suggest that the majority of American public is lazy when it comes to politics. Do you really think that they'll rise to the challenge?
Well, I'm skeptical of condemnation of the people mm-hmm. inside of a system where the people in so many ways just don't matter.
Okay.
You know, if you're a Republican in a safe seat district for Democrats, why would you vote? Like, mm-hmm. what are you going to get? You know that the representative doesn't care about you, doesn't care about your views. You're never going to matter.
Sure.
Same thing if you're a Democrat in a safe seat Republican district. Or if you see that the politician's bending over backwards to make the contributors to campaigns happy, if you're not a contributor to a campaign, why would you waste your time? You know, it's, you know, just not as significant. So I think that there's lots of good excuses right now for people not to be involved. I think if you eliminate those good excuses, then more people would be involved. And the way in which I want to get them involved is not something they would be doing every day or every week or even once a year. You know, if they get summoned to be on a citizen jury to reflect on some important issue of public policy, whether it's the question of whether we should have a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution or an amendment to overturn Citizens United or some issue around gun safety, you know, they can serve their week. I actually have a very generous set of proposals for making it very easy for people to be able to participate. And they would serve their week and they would feel proud to have contributed. They would be protected in their job if they had to go do it. So it's kind of like a draft, but it's a draft, a well-paid draft to civil service as opposed to military service. And I think it could begin to become part of an institution in America that complements the democratic mm-hmm. process in a way that gives people more confidence or more hope. So I think that people could rise to it, but we should at least create a democracy they should respect before we condemn them for not mm-hmm. respecting it.
Well, before we go, I have to ask, should voting be compulsory in the way that it is in Australia?
You know, again, I don't think it makes sense to force people to vote inside mm-hmm. of a system that isn't representing them.
Okay.
It's kind of adding insult to injury, right?
Right?
Now, if we did have a representative system, one where nobody had a right to complain about it not weighing people properly inside of the democracy, then I wouldn't be opposed to the idea of saying you ought to vote and we're going to enforce an obligation to vote. You know, we might do it in the American way, which is that we would pay them to vote. That would be fine with me. But I don't think we should be doing that before we have a democracy that we in good faith can say they ought to, because it really matters, participate in this democracy. Most of the time or often it just doesn't. And that seeds that sows the seeds of skepticism much more effectively mm-hmm. than we should have in this democracy.
Yeah. Well, you've got some very original and exciting ideas in this book. You really make us think. Once more, Lawrence Lessig's book is called They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Larry Lessig for coming on the show. You can order They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at Lessig. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.